This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The 2016 race for the White House charges on, and there are expectations from both sides of the aisle about the role of the 45th president, whoever that may be. So how has that office evolved, and what does history tell us about how presidents are judged? Joining me now is Bill Luchtenberg. He's a professor emeritus of history at UNC Chapel Hill. He's the author of more than a dozen books, one of the world's leading experts on Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His new book is The American President, From Teddy Roosevelt to Bill Clinton. And he's going to talk with me at the North Carolina Newsroom Cooperative event on Super Tuesday. But first, Bill Luchtenberg is here with us on the State of Things. Welcome to the program. Such a pleasure to have you.
Nice to be with you, Frank.
Also with us, enjoying the bliss of this conversation, is political junkie Ken Rudin. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Frank. I think you're enjoying the bliss of my conversation as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe not.
No, you know, we both eat it. This is the historical part, and I love it deeply, and the book is wonderful. You start your book with Teddy Roosevelt. Now, we've had more presidents than that, so why did you start with T.R.?
Well, it's a history of the presidency in the 20th century. Yeah. It starts with the assassination of William McKinley, and then I ask, why would anybody want to kill McKinley? Not only was he inoffensive, but the presidency had so little power in the late 19th century. And then Teddy Roosevelt comes in as a successor, and bang, we're off and running into an entirely different institution.
Tell us how he transformed the office.
He had a very strong sense of himself. There is a story that in one of his books, he used the word I so often that a typographer had to send out for a new supply in order to print the book. Unlike previous presidents, he cultivated the press. He made himself a figure everybody cared about, and perhaps a single incident indicates that more than any other. He was on a hunting trip in the South, and guides tied a bear to a tree, and he refused to shoot it. And by that time, that story had circulated through the press. The bear was a cub, and every child at Christmas wanted to have a teddy bear that Teddy Roosevelt had spared.
So, he's a guy who's a master of the media, and the media is becoming a thing now. This is when popular press is beginning to explode as well, and he figures out how to use that.
He did, and he had a keen sense of a national interest greater than that of any private interest, greater than that of the House of Morgan and all the financiers who were expanding at a rapid rate. During that period, he was the first president to intervene in a strike, not in order to crush the strike, but on behalf of justice for the laboring force, in this case, coal miners.
Bill, I was going to say, isn't the great irony of Teddy Roosevelt was that the Republican bosses hated him so much as governor of New York that they had him nominated for vice president so they can get him out of New York State, and they never expecting him to be president of the United States.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And one of the bosses said, I'm going to go down to the inauguration to see Theodore Roosevelt take the veil, that is to disappear from sight. And Roosevelt himself tried to figure out what he could do as a vice president, and he said he'd rather have to be anything, say, professor of history, than vice president of the United States.
This would not be the last time that a Republican populist candidate would run afoul of the machinery of the party. You talked about his popularity, his ability to win attention for himself, and you gave us one example of the way he may have transformed the office, intervening in a strike. How else did he actually transform the office of the presidency?
Well, he's generally regarded as the father of conservation. He used all kinds of constitutionally doubtful tools that a president may have in order to save vast areas of the United States. And in addition, though that we never have had a president who loved war more than Theodore Roosevelt, he winds up becoming the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize, and no American dies in a war during the time that he's in office from any war that he initiated. So there are numbers of paradoxes about Teddy Roosevelt.
So what about the, we're not going to just stay with Teddy Roosevelt, but the fact that he could take on populist causes suggests that there was a people, there was a population that he represented. And I wonder to what extent presidents lead or follow a kind of political sentiment in the country.
Well, he came to power at a time that the progressive movement was just getting underway. So it works in both directions, Frank. He was able to take advantage of that popular support, but also to kindle greater support, so that when he ran for a second term in 1904, he won overwhelmingly. And when he had to step down in 1908 at the Republican National Convention, a huge teddy bear was descended from the roof, and there were cries for a great many minutes of four years more.
Is there a ratchet effect in the presidency? In other words, as they take more power to the office, does it remain in the office, or is there a kind of waxing and waning in the 20th century?
Roosevelt, after a single term for William Howard Taft, his chosen successor, is followed by Woodrow Wilson, who in 8 years greatly expanded the presidency, initially by creating the Federal Reserve System and other aspects of the new freedom, but even more during World War I, when the national government greatly expanded, as did the institution of the presidency. And then he is followed by Warren Harding, then Calvin Coolidge, then Herbert Hoover, and there is, for the most part, a decline in the authority of the national government, in the power of the presidency. That's the time it wanes before it waxes again with the Great Depression and the emergence of Franklin Roosevelt.
Now, interestingly enough, Roosevelt is elected on a balance the budget ticket, right? I mean, here's his platform. We're going to balance the budget, no federal deficits. These guys have driven us into the ground. Again, more or less arguing for less government. And then we see his presidency evolve much differently. How much did the stress of the office itself and the times change Roosevelt?
Well, Roosevelt knew when he was running in 1932 that he was going to win easily because unless he made a mistake, because Herbert Hoover was so disliked, so blamed for the Depression and for not responding more vigorously. So, as you say, Roosevelt, particularly in a speech he gave at the Pittsburgh Pirates Old Ballpark, said that he was shocked by bureau piling on bureau, this terrible deficit that was built up. But he also said other things. He foreshadowed the creation of the Tennessee Valley Authority. He had been the governor who provided more aid than any other to the unemployed and promised that he would not neglect the so-called forgotten man.
I think it's interesting that in the early days of the Depression, when there was so much pressure on President Hoover to do something, and the Republicans felt that the chief executive didn't have all that power, so all the people who wanted the presidency to have more power certainly gave it to a President Roosevelt, given the Depression and then the oncoming World War II. But then when Roosevelt left office, you know, after his death in 1945, the Republicans were determined never again should a president have that much power. They put a constitutional amendment to limit the president to two terms. And basically, the Republican philosophy has been a weaker, a less powerful president and a more effective and stronger Congress.
Yeah, that's correct. And this is a changeover from the 19th century. In the era of Abraham Lincoln, the Republicans were regarded as the party that favored a strong union, whereas the Democrats were regarded as an organized no against the exercise of power. And particularly in the era of Theodore Roosevelt, and then, as you were saying, still more with Franklin Roosevelt, there was a decided turnaround.
So what happens when the Republicans regain the White House with the election of Eisenhower in terms of the presidency itself, and what does he do for the office?
He says that there's been too much pinkish influence in the country. He was a good deal more conservative than he was thought to be. He was regarded as a moderate Republican, but his main opponent, Robert Taft, was actually held some views considerably more progressive than Eisenhower's were. And yet, under Eisenhower, you get the creation of the new Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and you get the broad national highway system, the Eisenhower highways. And at the end of his regime, though nothing very much has changed in the direction of greater power for the national government, nothing has diminished either.
Although Eisenhower did pick Earl Warren to be the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the Warren Court was known for giving the federal government much more powers than taking it away from the states.
Yes, Eisenhower famously later said, choosing Warren was the biggest damn fool mistake I ever made. He said this not with respect to the Brown decision on civil rights, but with respect to reapportionment. Eisenhower was decidedly unhappy with the direction that the Warren Court assumed.
At the end of his presidency, also, he worried, and it seems to me when he talks about a military-industrial complex, the anxiety there seems to be about a loss of power, not only in the presidency, but in Congress itself, that power is shifting to more occult powers within the country, and this is something that seemed to worry him deeply.
That was a statement that nobody expected, and historians have been puzzling about it ever since. It was written by a man named Malcolm Moose, who was the president of the University of Minnesota, and we're not absolutely sure to what extent that represented Eisenhower's deepest convictions. But he certainly, at different times, particularly when there was a national panic over Russian gains in space, felt that there were times when this military-industrial complex had to be curbed.
We get to President Johnson, and there I think it's very telling about how events really move the presidency, particularly with regard to the civil rights movement, as he cautions Martin Luther King and urges patience, and Dr. King says we're moving forward, and ultimately moves the White House itself, pushes the president's hand.
Yes, I was on the Montgomery March with Martin Luther King, and remember the way that had changed in helping to bring about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But Johnson, even before then, clearly fueled by the civil rights movement, had from the very moment that he takes office after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, says to Congress that the greatest tribute we can give to Kennedy is to put through the Civil Rights Bill, which becomes the path-breaking Civil Rights Act of 1964.
And famously, when he signs it, he says, you know, I've just lost the South.
Yes.
So he knows that. How unique is that in the annals of the presidency to actually commit that kind of political suicide in the name of social justice?
Yeah. It's something that wasn't expected of Lyndon Johnson. He had strongly opposed most of the civil rights legislation before that time. He said that that was all that he could do as first a congressman, then a senator from Texas, that that's as far as his constituents would permit him. But once you enter the White House, you have a different view of the world, a different view of the nation, and you can attempt things that seemed to be forbidden before then.
You talk about how the pendulum switches between strong presidencies and weak presidencies. I think of Lyndon Johnson as an extremely strong president who's followed by Richard Nixon, who's not only a very strong president, but abuses his powers as president. And then he's followed by Gerald Ford. And then you have a Democratic Congress that does everything they can to make Ford one of the weakest chief executives in recent history.
Yeah, it's true that after Lyndon Johnson and then Richard Nixon, there's worry about Ignatius Schlesinger Jr.'s phrase, the imperial presidency. But after you've gotten through the Ford and Carter presidencies, Ford himself said, what we have is not an imperial presidency, but an imperiled presidency. And some people are saying with considerable exaggeration that the presidency as an institution is in grave danger. And that is the circumstance when Ronald Reagan is elected in 1980.
What's his impact on the office?
Most of Reagan's impact is in the first year of the presidency. Not very much legislation is adopted after that first year, but he gives a sense of great cheer, of hope. It's his personality more than any particular measures that mark his significance. And then he winds up with the Iran-Contra affair that raises once again alarm about the power of the presidency, particularly in foreign affairs.
So how had things changed by the end of that century when you were right about Bill Clinton, how the office changed, and what was his impact on the office?
The big change in the last half of the 20th century is clearly the development of the nuclear bombs and the fact that a president has his finger on the button. It's a frightening amount of power. Clinton takes office after 12 years of Republican rule, which is to say after a series of Democratic defeats. And he is a member, later an officer of the Democratic Leadership Council. He comes to office as a moderate. He again and again says, people say, if you elect me, you're going to get a liberal. He said, that's not what's going to happen. So Clinton all along had a restrained view of what was possible and what a president ought to do.
So now we're looking at 2016. This is perhaps one of the most raucous primary seasons we've ever had. What does it say, or does it say anything to you, Bill, about the office of the presidency and the regard with which we hold this office, given the kind of atmosphere that we see in the primary season?
One thing you can count on historians to say is that if you think things are bad now, X number of years earlier, things were still worse. But I'm one historian who won't say that about the situation in 2016. I think the institution of the presidency and the country itself is in considerable peril at the moment.
I want to thank you both. Bill Luchtenberger, Professor Emeritus of History at UNC Chapel Hill, the author of many books. His latest is The American President. He and I are going to chat some more Super Tuesday at an event at the NC Newsroom Cooperative. It's in RTP. We've got details on that appearance at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you. Nice being with you, Frank.
And the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, the music of Mount Moriah. Stay with us.